loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker, and joined in studio by John Kiriakou. In this hour, we take a look at several big stories as part of our regular Friday segment, The Week in Review, including Michael Cohen's testimony this week before Congress, the issue of reparations in the 2020 election, the Kim Trump summit in Hanoi, and the election in Nigeria.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. The U.S. Treasury Department launched new sanctions against six individuals from Venezuela today, alleging that they're associated with obstruction of humanitarian aid deliveries into the country. Meanwhile, Venezuelan Vice President Delcy Rodriguez met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Moscow, after which Venezuelan President Maduro announced that an office of Venezuela's state oil company will relocate there. Kurdish militias launched an attack today on the last pocket of ISIS fighters in an area around less than a quarter of a square mile in eastern Syria. They evacuated six truckloads of civilians from the region of Baghouz before launching the attack. A day after a UN report was issued presenting evidence of violations of international law carried out by the country's armed forces, Israeli forces used live ammunition on protesters today at the Gaza-Israel border, injuring 12 people. Yesterday's UN report found that since the, quote, Great March of Return protests began, unquote, last year, 189 Palestinians have died and more than 9,000 have been injured as a result of Israeli attacks, including more than 7,600 from live ammunition or shrapnel. Walmart has instituted a new policy that would change front door people greeters to customer hosts, a role change that would include additional tasks like handling refunds and checking shopping carts and would require being able to lift up to 25 pounds. Many people with disabilities have objected, saying that the new requirements would put them out of a job. More than 18,000 people signed a petition for one greeter in North Carolina who has cerebral palsy. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to our weekly segment, The Week in Review. We'll talk about the week in politics, policy, and international affairs with Jacqueline Lukman and Abdus Lukman. They are the co-editor-in-chiefs of Lukman Nation. Check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. Welcome back.
Thanks for having us back.
Hey, thanks for having us back.
So, Jackie, where would you like to start today?
So, I think what happened in Nigeria with the Nigerian elections, very, very interesting. I'm actually kind of surprised by the outcome of the election where the incumbent, who was corrupt anyway, won. But his opponent, the opposition party, just as corrupt. There's just many, many years of corruption. The Nigeria's president, Muhammadu Buhari, was reelected for a second term. There are, you know, years and years of accusations of corruption by him. People have been wondering if he's even fit to serve because he's older and he's been kind of spacing out a little bit in public. But the Election Commission actually suspended elections for a week in Nigeria. And that's really important because in a place like Nigeria that doesn't have the infrastructure that we do have in the United States, where we're used to having a polling station in a relatively convenient place, except for, you know, poor and black communities and native reservations that have been the victim of voter suppression, where polling stations were closed. In Nigeria, people have to travel days. They have to travel for days to the next largest capital city or the next largest city to get to a polling station. So by the time the Election Commission suspended elections 2 weeks ago for a week, people had already begun traveling from their homes. So then a lot of people went back. So voter turnout in this election in Nigeria was at the lowest point that it has ever been. And that a lot of people are saying, especially Buhari's opposition, Atiku Abubakar, is claiming that that's a part of this voter suppression, that he believes it resulted in him losing this election, even in areas of the country where he had massive, almost 75% support. And then there was also Boko Haram, who was out literally killing people to either keep them from voting for Abubakar or to force people, I mean, literally to terrorize people to go to the polls to vote for, these are the reports out of Nigeria, to vote for Buhari. So we don't know if this election is going to stand. Abubakar is saying that he is going to actively oppose it in the courts. There are a lot of questions. And once again, Nigeria's democracy is once again under siege.
Yeah, it's a huge issue. I mean, Nigeria is the largest country in Africa. I think the population is about 200 million. There's a dispute between Nigeria and South Africa who has the biggest economy, but it's probably the largest economy in Africa too. Major oil exporter, right? One of the members of OPEC, I believe.
That's right.
So there's been a number of coup d'etats. I mean, elections are traditionally sort of contentious affairs. And it's also a highly federalized system of government too, where different sort of geographic political regions. So there's like south, south, southeast, southwest. All of these are sort of like their own kind of distinct political scene. So yeah, I mean, it's something that it got a little bit of coverage in the U.S. press. I think not nearly enough when you consider like how like huge the country is. Yeah, Abdus, what are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, let's remember this: that one of the biggest problems that Buhari was having during his term was the economy. If you ask the average Nigerian on the street, it was like, look, we can't find jobs, the economy, the inflation, it's everything, we just do not have the economic opportunities that we need. Also, we have to remember, too, is the environmental destruction that a lot of Nigerians have had to face, especially in the Niger Delta region, when you had oil companies, British and American oil companies, which basically, because of deregulations and corruption and everything else, have turned these once beautiful natural spaces into basically oil deserts. I mean, so all of these things are affecting Nigeria, along with the security issues and everything else. I think that, and it's mighty funny, Walter, that you bring up OPEC, because this is one thing, and I'll make this brief, is the fact that Nigeria produces the best crude out of OPEC.
Don't they call that the sweet crude?
They call that the sweet crude. It's better than Saudi Arabia, better than anything that the other OPEC nations are producing. But then we have to ask ourselves, why hasn't Nigeria benefited financially like their OPEC, other OPEC members have? So all of these things come into play when it comes to the overall picture of Nigeria.
And, the issue of environmental destruction is also interesting, I think, when it comes to the Boko Haram insurgency in the north. So, I mean, that war started, I believe, in 2009, and it has a lot to do, I think, with climate change. I mean, so the Saharan Desert is expanding because of climate change. More and more land that could have been used for other stuff is now just becoming desert. And so in the north of the country, which is the predominantly Muslim part of Nigeria, the south is mostly Christian because when the British colonized it, they were mostly interested in the ports in the south. So there's, some people are farmers, other people are, herders, right? And so when there's a limited, shrinking amount of land that can be used for either one of those two types of activities, that creates conflict, right? That destabilizes the society. And out of that, or in that vacuum, I guess you could say, sort of these extreme, theocratic movements can emerge. Let's go on then. We've had a lot of news here in Washington on Capitol Hill with Michael Cohen's testimony, marathon testimony. There's some behind closed doors, some out in the open. What's your take on it?
Well, unfortunately, people are making Michael Cohen out to be this hero. This is just such a bizarre turn of events with people on the so-called left that Michael Cohen is like their hero because they actually thought that he was going to say something in this hearing that might take down Trump. And it's not that there was not information that we hadn't heard before, but Cohen also didn't corroborate this whole Russiagate collusion with Russia business that so many people have been hanging their hats and hopes of getting rid of Trump on. And then just the idea that Cohen himself, this hearing kind of made him into this sympathetic figure, when this is a man who himself said that for 10 years he willingly worked for a man who told him to intimidate and threaten people to do what he wanted them to do. And he did it. And he said that he was proud to be the personal attorney of Donald Trump. But now he comes to Capitol Hill and in this hearing and he's, spilling all the tea. But he's only doing it because of the investigation into Donald Trump that he got named in. during the election, during the Republican primaries, not a peep from Cohen, not a peep.
You know, one of the things that disturbs me, though, we all watched this Cohen thing, and he testified in closed session yesterday. It turns out he's going to testify again in closed session before the House Intelligence Committee sometime next week. But compare this hearing to any of the Watergate hearings. In the Watergate hearings, both sides wanted to know the truth. Howard Baker famously said, if you recall, what did the president know and when did he know it? Yesterday was not that kind of a hearing.
No.
Yesterday, the battle lines were clearly drawn and it didn't make a whit of difference what Michael Cohen had to say. The Republicans had their story and the Democrats had their story, and never the two shall meet.
Yeah. Yeah. What was interesting, I think, to me was all of the Republicans just coming right out and saying,
You know,
listen, how can you sit here and smear the president?
You, sir, are a liar.
Yes. Yeah. And it's like, okay, well, yes, Michael Cohen is a liar. So that's not, you know, some great declaration of truth either. But I mean, that can't be your defense for why that can't be like the rebuttal for why Cohen has to say should be thrown. I mean, it's just a whole messy charade. It was entertaining, but, you know.
Well, one of the things that I thought was interesting is the fact that you had Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
Oh,
you
yes.
know, so it's like, okay, now we have two people of questionable character, you know, sitting up here going back and forth. But another thing is that where do we go from here? Right now, Cohen is definitely not a hero, not in my book anyway. I mean, he was doing Trump's bidding, doing this whole thing. But where do we go from here? Nancy Pelosi then already had a press conference and said, well, look, we can't use this to impeach him. But what I do think that we may gain, what I think it has shed light on is that there is some evidence of collusion here. So there's definitely, I mean, maybe not enough to do anything with, because one of the things about impeaching the president is the fact that, and I think Ford said this back in 70, that, you know, the offenses of impeaching the president is whatever they want it to be. You know what I mean?
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, right now, you know, Nancy Pelosi didn't already, you know, let all of the, you know, those of us who want to see Trump go, saying, well, look, we ain't going to use that. You know, but I think, though, that because Trump, this really bothered him when he was over in Vietnam, you know, meeting with Kim. You know, this is putting...
Yeah, that fire under his
feet. We'll see where this goes.
I think the really interesting thing is, I think you're right that Cohen's testimony spoke to obvious collusion, but it wasn't with the people that everybody kept saying.
Exactly.
He didn't collude with Russia. He colluded with Cohen to try to shut Stormy Daniels up. But I like that you asked, where do we go from here, Abdus, because the new progressives in the House actually, I think, provided the path for where the Democrats might go from this hearing with whatever they're going to do with Trump. And it does involve his taxes, because Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez asked specific questions about how Trump lied on his taxes, basically. How did he devalue his property? Did he really report the value of his property, and how did he do this? And who else was involved? And she got him to mention three other names of people that we had not heard before. So it's entirely possible that that line of questioning could result in some, I don't know, some further investigation into those three people and what they have to say about Trump's taxes. I thought that was interesting. And of course, I can't not mention the exchange between Representative Mark Meadows.
Oh, the best.
Oh, wow.
The best.
Right.
And Representative Rashida Tlaib.
Yes.
The fact that Lynn Patton would allow herself to be used in that capacity as a prop, because Meadows didn't ask her to come because she was a personal friend of the Trump family. He asked her to come because he literally said, how can Mr. Trump be a racist when he hired this black woman right here in an executive position? And she stood there and let him do it. And Rashida Tlaib said that anybody would use a black woman as a prop is just a racist act. And of course, Mr. Birther in Chief, chair of the Freedom Caucus, you know.
He's like crying.
He faked a cry. Then he called upon his black friend to vouch for him.
Best friends are black.
And Elijah Cummings indulged him and you know, told the world that he was a nice white man. And, you know, he was even.
Well, he and Tlaib hugged afterwards.
It was a mess.
They hugged.
It was a horrible, horrible mess. But it was a mess I think we needed to see.
But this is the reason why so many of us, especially in the black political circles, want people like Cummings and John Lewis and all the rest of them to just sit down. The fact that Elijah Cummings would allow his reputation and would allow himself to be used in that way, I thought was disgraceful. You know, I mean, basically this just say, no. He's a good friend of mine, and I'm going to put on his forehead the stamp of civil rights approval. You know, I mean, this was just as shameful, if I may indulge a little bit. This was just as shameful as the civil rights heroes coming off of Mount Olympus during the Super Bowl. You know, knowing how black folks feel about the Super Bowl and Kaepernick and, you know, just being used in that way.
The coin toss, right?
Right. To be used in that way. So, we talk about the black misleadership class and Cummings. I mean, to me, I just felt like Cummings should not have allowed himself, because now you talk about Lynn Patton being used that way. Well, I think that Cummings was also used as a prop, too. You know, here it is. Trump's not racist, because look at this. And then I'm not racist. Am I, Cummings? No, we've been friends a long time.
No, he's my best. He's one of my best friends. Okay, let's not.
And I also don't think Rashida Tlaib needed to back down like she did either, because she was just like, oh, well, I didn't call him a racist. I just thought it was a racist act that he did in this particular moment. And it's just like, you know, that I think that kind of sums up a lot about what this sort of like incoming class of like progressive freshmen is, because, you know, on the one hand, I appreciate a lot of the stuff that, you know, that they do. Ilhan Omar is also part of it. You know, like I thought what she did with Elliot Abrams was great, but they kind of do still want to be part of the club at the end of the day. Right. So she had to like backtrack and be like, no, we're colleagues, blah, blah, blah. Like, I think that like what we kind of need are people who don't care about being in the club at all.
Exactly.
Yes, agreed.
Let's keep going with the testimony, though, because it was so
rich.
Yeah. And so there's, I mean, this is kind of less consequential, but there's just some like funny things that we learned about Donald Trump, which, again, I mean, this is just Michael Cohen claiming it. But some of this stuff sounds completely believable to me. Like, OK, like the fact that he threatened the former schools that he went to did not release his grades or his SAT score. Do you guys believe that?
Actually, I think one of the schools did release. Didn't they release the letter, or they confirmed that they did receive a letter from Trump's attorney threatening?
Oh, yeah. Fordham. Fordham received a letter from Cohen.
Yeah, he really did. So they're like, yeah, he's telling the truth. He did threaten us not to release his grades. And we thought it was funny then. That's why we're releasing the letter. But I think that speaks to just the level of narcissism and megalomania this man has. Like, everything is just all about how he can throw his weight around. That's all his entire presidency is. It's all it ever has been. And I think that's a great example of that.
Abdus, there is also a story that emerged that he used Trump charity funds or Trump organization funds to inflate the price of a portrait of himself so that it would sell for more money.
That's right.
And then also there was a conversation that was recounted about going to Vietnam and bone spurs, and how he told Michael Cohen, basically at the conclusion of the sentence, like, you think I'm dumb? I'm not going to go to Vietnam, or I wasn't going to go to Vietnam. I mean, it's just, it shows, right, how much of an isolated, rich person life he's lived, right?
And you're right, Walton. Also, it gives evidence of the bubble that he's grown up in. The fact that he's not shamed about none of this stuff shows that he's been enabled his entire life of responding in these types of ways. So, you know, if it was someone who made their money, like if he was a self-made guy, he would still carry some of the morals and some of the value system of when he was poor. But because he grew up the way that he grew up, he's been enabled his entire life to be and do whatever he wants to do.
Totally. So let's talk about the overall big picture. What's the significance of this before we move on? Because, you know, there are some other pieces, like, you know, he had to throw in something about Russia so that people would pay attention to it. So he said, I overheard Trump talking to Roger Stone on the phone. And then there was something about, you know, Trump, I think it was Trump Jr. who came in and whispered something about, you know, the Moscow Project, meaning just a hotel, right? That was actually, we should always emphasize, was never actually built, right? I mean, if there was, if the price of American democracy was like permits for a Trump hotel in Moscow, don't you think like the government would have done it? But, you know, that was thrown in the mix. It became part of the headlines. Do you think this is going to be consequential, or is it going to be just sort of a passing fad?
The Russia angle, I think the extent to which Trump has used the office to try to continue to push building this Trump hotel in Russia that Vladimir Putin has obviously never wanted. Because if he wanted it after Trump trying to build it for 30 years, it would have been built by now. I don't understand the disconnection in logic that people just can't wrap around their heads, that this is the so-called Russian collusion, not that Putin is, you know, tried to steal the election, but that Trump has literally been trying to build a luxury hotel so Russian oligarchs can give him more money in Russia. That's really all it is. But I think that the issue is that he's tried to continue to do this while he is president of the United States, and he's tried to do this through the office of president of the United States. Outside of that, I can't see it being a bigger issue than that because there is no evidence of anything else.
Abdus, before we move on, what's Michael Cohen thinking? Why did he go through all this? Is he, we were speculating earlier in the week that it might be because, you know, he just wants to write a book and be famous and, you know, be sort of embraced. Do you think that's it?
Yeah, I think it's it. He accepted his fate. I mean, you know, he's probably sitting here wishing that he'd done some things different. But, you know, he's looking at the book deal, the movie deal and all the other kind of stuff while he goes down to Club Fed.
I mean, wasn't he asked by one of the congressmen, you know, do you intend to get a book deal out of this? And then Cohen said, yes, I do.
But if I may add one thing about the Russian hotel, you know, Trump, and we already said this about Trump, is one thing of being able to deal with the five families in New York to get your stuff built. It's another thing having to deal with, you know where I'm going at over there in Moscow trying to get something built. So I'll leave it there.
So the other huge piece of news this week was the U.S.-Korea summit in Vietnam, right? Which people thought, you know, oh, there's going to be a deal. We expected there to be an official end to the Korean War declared. But nothing happened. There is no deal. What do you think? Were you surprised?
Literally nothing happened.
Nothing.
Yeah. I'm still kind of waiting for something to happen other than Trump saying that, well, you know, we're pulling away from demanding any real kind of oversight of any arms ramp ups or, you know, any arms action in North Korea, which when you think about it, when you really think about it and you understand how greedy Donald Trump really is, because this is all about money. This isn't about diplomacy. And it would be great for there to be an end to that conflict on the Korean Peninsula. But for Trump, this is about that $6 trillion of minerals that he's hoping he can get some of his friends to capitalize on in North Korea. That I really believe that's all this that's all this whole summit business is about, which is why he's willing to kind of look the other way and not monitor North Korea's nuclear program.
I kind of think that there's something else involved, too. I think that it's not just the United States not willing to allow these things to go play. You know, the United States have to worry about Japan. Now, I remind you now, North Korea rocket program shooting nuclear weapons all over the place. It's a threat to Japan, who has not have that capability to really do anything about it. So I kind of think that we're looking at Japan, we're looking at South Korea, we're looking at other allies in the region, maybe even China. Because then if North Korea and South Korea comes together and say it's the end of the war, then what you need U.S. troops there for? So what's going to be there in order to check the Chinese growing military influence?
So I think that's a huge part. You know, this idea that North Korea, which I find to be a ridiculous argument, that North Korea is just going to launch like a first strike nuclear assault on, you know, the biggest military power
to
ever.
Who would do that?
It's clearly, you know, the them developing a nuclear weapon clearly was like a defensive deterrent thing because, you know, they have, like you mentioned, there's 30,000 U.S. troops all along the border. Like, imagine if there are 30,000 North Korean troops along the U.S.-Canada border. I mean, how the United States would react to that.
But can I ask a question real quick, Walter? Is the fact that having North Korea has proven, they've proven that in order for the United States to treat you with any kind of respect, you have to go nuclear.
I mean, I think that's a logical conclusion that a lot of countries are probably going to draw, right? I mean, yeah, Iraq, right, disarmed invaded and destroyed. Libya, kind of a similar thing too, right? Almost happened to Syria. I think that North Korea kind of shows like you gotta force them to the negotiating table. So I really thought that they had kind of done it. I mean, Donald Trump, I agree that, you know, a unified Korea would have like tremendous economic potential. I think that's absolutely true. But I think that Donald Trump might be thinking more like in terms of electoral, like 2020 considerations. You know, like, is this a victory that I can point to on the campaign trail and say, like, I'm a great deal maker. I did this thing. Nobody else could do it.
Yeah. I thought the introduction, and I agree, I think you're absolutely right, because again, I think we also have to keep in mind that Donald Trump has never stopped campaigning. I mean, like, never. Since the day he was inaugurated, he's been still campaigning, doing his rally. So I think you're right, Walter, that this is, you know, something that he can mention on the campaign trail in 2020. But I think it's a shame, though, that they planned this nice lunch for them and they didn't even show up. which I think speaks, I think it reflects so poorly on, and I'm surprised I'm even saying this, that this man can't even uphold a hint of diplomacy, that he can't even sit through a lunch and pretend to want to have a decent diplomatic relations with a not only a world leader, but like you said, Abdus, a nuclear power.
Yeah, I mean, what happened? Do you think that it was dissension like within the Trump administration, right? Because, you know, Trump is looking out for Trump. But then the people, you know, Mike Pompeo, John Bolton, you know, these are like career guys who actually have studied how the U.S. maintains an empire around the world. And, you know, they might have like very different thoughts about Korea. And also, what do you think about the response of the Democrats? Because the Democrats, again, were just like, we're so down on the possibility of any progress for the Korean people towards peace and reunification. I mean, wow, those two things were striking to me.
I think what the funny side of me thinks that Trump wanted McDonald's and he just and that lunch was too fancy for him and he just didn't want to, you know. But the serious side of me believes that when Kim Jong-un said, no, we're not going to stop our nuclear program, we are not going to denuclearize. I am not going to denuclearize North Korea. Nope. Then that's when I think Donald Trump said, okay, well, I'm leaving. I really do believe it was just that simple. The Democrats in the issues of anti-imperialism and anti-war, side along with some other issues, continue to be a constant disappointment, because we should want there to be an end to decades of military conflict everywhere in this world. We should want that. We would think that they would want that, but they're too invested in the military-industrial complex, too.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and return with more of our weekly regular segment, The Week in Review. We're talking with Jacqueline Lookman and Abdus Lookman. They're the co-editors-in-chief of Lookman Nation. Check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
This is our weekly segment, The Week in Review, where we talk about the biggest stories this week in politics, policy, and international affairs with Jacqueline Lookman and Abdus Lookman. They're the co-editors-in-chief of Lookman Nation. Check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. Welcome back.
Thanks for having us back.
Let's open up and talk about the 2020 presidential campaign. I mean, there's lots of different things going on. You know, the opinion polls are starting to leak out. We can kind of get a general sense of who the biggest contenders are. Bernie Sanders now fully in the race. How's it shaping up?
Well, the Democrats are employing the Republican strategy from 2016, where they're flooding the field with every Democratic candidate under the sun, with, we believe, is really the intention of drowning out support for Bernie Sanders. Not that people should not be allowed to run. I think anybody who wants to run for president should run for president. But the Democrat strategy, I think, is pretty transparent. They've got this really crowded field pretty early, and they did pretty early a few months ago, with the intention of already putting out, you know, a couple of front runners, specifically Kamala Harris and at the time Cory Booker. But now it's kind of swinging toward Joe Biden as he hints at maybe he's going to run. Now, Jay Inslee says he's going to run on a platform of climate change. And I mean, this is all great. You've got Marianne Williamson, who is Oprah Winfrey's spiritual advisor. Why can't I say that without laughing?
I know, I laugh too, but do you think she's going to be invited to the debates? Is she a legitimate candidate?
I don't know that she is a quote unquote legitimate candidate, but I think that she was smart in opening her campaign with an issue that Bernie Sanders ignored in 2016. And that's another thing the Democrats are doing. The Democratic Party is very transparent with their strategy. Because Bernie Sanders ignored, brushed off reparations in 2016, of course, now all of the Democratic candidates, the front runners, are picking up reparations as an issue they claim they support. But not one of them has actually mentioned the legislation that would convene a study to examine reparations and determine how to actually implement them, which is H.R. 40. So this is a criticism that we still have of Bernie Sanders, especially after that town hall, even though the people who asked the questions in that town hall were obvious Democratic Party plant, obvious. The answer to the question is still the same. Yes, we need to figure out how to do reparations. Let's get H.R. 40 passed. It's really that simple. But at the same time, a lot of people on the left are using this criticism of Sanders still being wishy-washy on this issue as like just dismissal of him. We have to criticize all the candidates on all the issues. That is the entire point of being an educated electorate. You know, we can't just... It's not a popularity contest. And people have treated electoral politics in the United States as a popularity contest for too long. And that has served marginalized communities badly for a very long time. And we just can't afford to do it anymore. So it's great that Inslee is thrown his hat into the race. It's great that he's brought climate change as an issue to the fore. But we would say to him, we being Lukeman Nation would say to him, just like we'd say to every other candidate, what are you going to do about reparations? If you don't want to call it reparations, fine. Restitution, economic justice, call it what you want in the context of Black people and how your platform is going to address the systemic issues we face.
Well, I wanted to say that Marianne Williamson, Oprah's spiritual advisor, she is running. This is actually Oprah running for president.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm serious. Because remember, everybody was calling for Oprah to get into the ring and we should have Oprah run for president. And Oprah said, no, I don't want to be president. But what Oprah did was send a proxy in. So what Marianne Williamson is going to do, she actually is representing Oprah as president without Oprah actually being there. That's just my take.
What do you guys think about Beto O'Rourke, too? He reportedly is going to jump in the next 2 or 3 days. Is that going to matter at all? Or is this just another DNC-approved moderate?
It's another DNC-approved moderate. You know, the Democrats have always been looking for another Kennedy. They have always been looking for another JFK. And they see it in Beto O'Rourke, I believe. You know, they've always been looking for that. But I think that what Jackie had mentioned, I think that the fix is already in. I know people don't want me to say that, but the fix is already in. Beto O'Rourke, you know, that he would be that symbolic figure that the DNC really would want. And I think that the reason why the field is so crowded now, because everybody feels I could beat Trump now.
I think you're right. And that's why we're going to have 2 dozen plus Democratic candidates for president.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. They smell blood in the water and they think, well, why not me?
Why not me? Exactly. Exactly. I agree.
What about Joe Biden? Joe Biden is sort of like the big, all the opinion polls show him at the top of the field. But again, it's so early that could just be a name recognition thing. I mean, Joe Biden seems like an awful candidate to me. But again, people are talking about him like, oh, he's the one. He's the front. I mean, technically speaking, I guess he is kind of the front runner if you just want to go by the early opinion polls. But yeah, what do you think about Joe Biden's prospects?
Please, no creepy Uncle Joe.
Well, you know, I read something today that what's going to do him in is the first time he sits for an interview and then gets up and walks over to the female interviewer and closes his eyes and starts to sniff her hair. That will finally
massage her shoulders.
Exactly.
Yes.
That will finally do him in.
Yes. I think that a large segment of the American electorate has become a little bit more educated on politics and policies since 2016. I think that has been the good thing of this whole Sanders quote unquote revolution, if you want to call it. And that's been the great thing about social media. There's been, you know, some crazy misinformation spread around too, but people understand that you can go to GovTrack now and you can look up legislation and you can go to Open Secrets and look at who is actually getting money from what super PAC. So people understand a little bit more about the political process, and they feel a little bit more empowered to look into who these people who have been around politics forever really are. And that's going to be a challenge for Joe Biden because he's got a lot of messy stuff to answer for.
Yeah, I was really impressed with how strong the Sanders campaign opened. I think that he could pretty easily blow Biden out of the water and probably most of these other people, too, because, I mean, so one is the fundraising totals, right? I think in the first 24 hours, if you compare sort of like how much money did you make in the first 24 hours, his total is more than all the other candidates combined, I think.
Right.
So clearly a motivated support base there. And it's mostly not like rich people, right, who are donating to Bernie Sanders, too. So it's like a huge like quantity of donors, too. And then you've got the maybe more impressively, like the million plus people who signed up to be volunteers. I think it was like 600,000 within the first 24 hours. And now they've, you know, significantly surpassed their goal of 1 million, right? So it seems like Sanders is not backing down, because the big question then is like, okay, if you're the fundraiser, the front runner, do you then moderate your position so that you kind of just are secure and play it safe and whatever? It seems like he's not doing that in terms of like economic issues, right? So, you know, he's still talking about the billionaire class and the 1% and how we have to, you know, like change things in a big way. The big question that I'm looking for is, well, so one is, you know, what we were talking about earlier with the question of reparations, like has he sort of learned how to persuasively and effectively talk about racial justice? And also on the international front, you know, the Democratic Party, even though, you know, certain ideas have been embraced by a lot more politicians than before, you know, the Green New Deal, Medicare for All, education for all, on the international front, they've moved far to the right. I mean, they want to outflank Trump from the right. And so does Sanders go along with that? Does he embrace that? His statements about Venezuela haven't been good, for instance. Or does he sort of, you know, chart his own course? That's the big question that I'm looking at least.
Well, Sanders still supports empire. He still supports American imperialism all over. He still supports Israeli imperialism, Israeli human rights abuse with respect to against the Palestinians. Maybe not directly saying that, but I haven't heard him really have a strong statement against, you know, what's been happening in Israel. So I don't think that he has become enlightened as far as the American war machine go, American imperialism. And like you said, with respect to Venezuela, he was towing the same party line along with everyone else. As far as reparations go, and we've been going through this with what I call the black media, Lukeman Nation and others, where we have Sanders supporters, mainly white Sanders supporters, who are really coming at us because we raise these issues of reparations. We raise these issues. Now, the question that you asked, have Sanders answered these questions or on the right side, you know, to our approval? No, you know, but I put a but there because I feel that this is someone that Jackie and I were talking about, this Sanders we could talk to. Jackie and I was up in Philadelphia when he ran the first time in 100 degree heat in Philadelphia, supporting Bernie Sanders even after he stated publicly that he wouldn't support reparations. So we feel that in this field of candidates now, Bernie Sanders may be the most sincere. This is what we say. But on Lukeman Nation, we don't endorse any candidate. And that's the thing that a lot of his supporters have been coming at us. Bernie has his own beehive and they've been coming at us pretty heavy. But I think that he's going to eventually get it. And I think that he is more sincere on these issues than Booker and Harris and all the rest of them. So
just out of curiosity, what would reparations look like? Would reparations be presented in the form of like a tax credit? Would it be a check to families, to individuals? How would that work?
I would say all of the above. But the thing of it is that when we're asked that question in Lukeman Nation, Jackie and I, we always refer people to H.R. 40. We refer to H.R. 40 because it has sort of like an outline of what reparations could look like. We also refer them to, for those who want to know why we're asking for reparations, We refer them to Ta-Nehisi Coates' article on the case for reparations. So the work has been done. I think, Jackie, you said something about NCOBRA.
Yeah, the organization NCOBRA that has been working on reparations in America, along with international organizations, for decades and decades and decades. We always bring up Dr. Charles Ogletree, who, unfortunately, as a great mind, a great legal mind, a great scholar that we're losing to Alzheimer's. But you can find his work on YouTube. That's the beauty of social media again. So all of this work that we have been doing for years and years and years on the issue of reparations, I think the thing that bothered us so much about Sanders' response at that town hall was he asks, what does reparations look like? What does it mean? And H.R. 40 has been introduced first by Representative John Conyers, and now it's been taken up by Representative Sheila Jackson Lee since 1989. It's never passed. It's never gotten out of committee, but it's been introduced in the House every single year since 1989. There is no way Bernie Sanders does not know about this bill. So he's asking a question that he actually has seen the answer to, but he didn't want to reference it. But he brought up another piece of legislation that has nothing to do with addressing the issue of systemic racism and restitution for centuries of racial injustice against Black people in particular. But he brought up a piece of legislation that was about addressing distressed rural communities. So that seemed kind of, I understand it was political. I understand it was a political calculation, but I felt like it was also not really entirely honest in the discussion of addressing the problem.
Well, and then the hypocrisy of it all is the fact that Sanders was in Congress when they passed the JUST Act. And so Jackie and I, we've been, you know, since we first came across this, we've been, a lot of our followers, we've been telling them, go look at the JUST Act. This just passed not too long ago, within the last few months. So Sanders was in, he was in Congress when this act was passed. And for anyone who wants to know what the JUST Act is, it's just more reparations for Jewish survivors of the Holocaust. Something that did not happen here. And not only is it reparations for Jewish survivors of the Holocaust, the wording of it is the fact that the United States is taking the responsibility of making sure that other countries pay Jewish survivors of the Holocaust. It's also making saying that they worded it where it says the Holocaust era. So we don't even know what that means. You know, so the reason why African Americans, why we're so basically on this issue, in spite of what a lot of our white friends might not like, but we're on this issue because this is twice within the last 20 years that this government has seen fit to give reparations to Jewish survivors of the Holocaust and then tell us we can't get anything. And then there's still the issue of $3 billion a year going to Israel, a country that really doesn't need our money, that's going to Israel and continue to strengthen their economy, their war machine, everything else. But yet you're telling the poorest people in this country, which is us, that we can't get anything.
Right. And at the same time, repeatedly asking the question, well, what does reparations look like? Everyone in Congress knows what reparations looks like. That's not even a question that any of them can legitimately ask anymore.
Right. And, you know, so reparations, you know, the concept of giving reparations to an aggrieved people who dealt with some sort of like extreme historical injustice, you know, it's not a new concept. Right. So, you know, survivors of the Holocaust, you know, this horrible cataclysm where millions and millions of people died, you know, so there's reparations there. Right. There's, you know, a movement in Namibia, for instance, for reparations from Germany because Germany conducted a genocide when they were the colonial rulers of Namibia as well. So there's, you know, there's another movement for reparations there. And of course, you know, there's this longstanding demand for African Americans to also have reparations. I mean, going back to the Civil War, right? I mean, the 40 acres and a mule, you know, classic. So, you know, it's like this longstanding thing. It's not like it's been invented for the 2020 campaign cycle.
Exactly.
The Democrats who said they're for it, you know, like we're saying, obviously that's just like a political maneuver too. But yeah, I thought it was kind of, Sanders seemed to just like be confused, like not know how to handle it. Like he was just sort of going back and forth and vacillating. It seems like he was truly like caught off guard, which was bad. I mean, I don't know why he wasn't prepared for that. But yeah, I mean, interesting. We're going to see how all of this shapes up. Any final thoughts on the 2020 election?
I think that, you know, we do what we do in Lukeman Nation with every single one of the candidates. I mean, people who are listening to this, y'all, please calm down. We're not beating up on Bernie Sanders because he's Bernie Sanders, because we don't like Sanders. No, these are issues that we demand every single candidate address, just like everybody is demanding that all the candidates address what they're going to do about climate change, what they're going to do about the minimum wage, what they're going to do about Medicare for all. Well, this is our demand. So This is you know, educated voters being educated voters.
Yeah, you have to treat us like adults. And this was something that a lot of us never got over with Barack Obama. When Barack Obama was campaigning, he came to the black community and basically just chastised us, finger wagged at us and everything, and for the benefit of the white vote. He never discussed policy. He never discussed any of those things with us. And so many of us who were paying attention at that time are saying, no, you don't get a chance to do that again. So whether it's Booker or Kamala Harris or anyone else, Elizabeth Warren, any of them, if you come and speak to us, then you have to treat us like adults. And like the, and if you want our votes, then you have to give us the respect of talking, of speaking with the issues with us, and not just come along and say you got hot sauce in your bag or do the wobble or all of these other so-called black cultural references that they think is going to be enough to satisfy us. No, when you come up, you have to treat us like you do every other demographic.
Important points. Let's switch gears here now and go back to the international situation. We have just about 10 minutes left, and I'm hoping that we can talk about both what happened between India and Pakistan, because the world came very close to a really devastating conflict there. And also there are some important developments in Israel and Palestine. Let's start with the India-Pakistan clash. I mean, what went on? Why was it so dangerous?
Well, once again, it's Kashmir, you know, this disputed territory of Kashmir. There was something about something that was connected to a so-called terrorist group and attacks where some Indian soldiers unfortunately lost their lives. But again, this area of Kashmir has never been solved. I mean, India and Pakistan fought three wars over it so far. The reason why this makes it such a dangerous situation, like you brought up, Walter, is because these are two nuclear armed powers. Now, they might not have the arsenal of America or Russia, but still, even in the limited nuclear exchange between them two would cause global consequences.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was reading an article where even, I mean, it's so weird to talk about like a limited nuclear war, right? But even, you know, a quote unquote limited nuclear exchange, it would create firestorms that kick up so much like dirt and ash into the air that there would be everywhere around the world, you know, huge famines. And I mean, it's so bad. And, you know, I would argue that this is all just a legacy of like colonial divide and conquer policies, right? Because, you know, all of the Indian subcontinent, South Asia, you know, however you want to characterize it, was sort of one colony under Britain, right? And there were many, many tons and tons of different nationalities and ethnicities and kingdoms and principalities that was in that geographical territory. But it was all sort of governed as one British colony. And so in 1947, when, you know, the independence movement kind of reached its fruition, there was an effort to partition, and there was a partition of the Indian subcontinent. And it was done primarily along religious lines, although that's not 100% how it went down, because I think the largest or second largest population of Muslims in the world is actually in India.
It is. There are actually more Muslims in India than there are in Pakistan.
Yeah,
that's true. Yeah.
So, right. But it was sort of loosely based on religious grounds. You know, they knew that India was going to be an ally of the Soviet Union, and it was. And so there's some very strategically important deep water ports in what became Pakistan. They wanted to deny that to the Soviet Union. And so basically, as part of this big scramble, which is a very bloody process, the different principalities had to decide, okay, am I going to be part of Pakistan or am I going to be part of India? Kashmir was one of those states that was governed by a prince or a king. And basically, and I think the monarchy was just like, okay, we're going to be part of India. But then there was, you know, many people who wanted to be part of Pakistan and, you know, the Pakistani movement. So, right. And so it sort of became this unresolved territorial conflict that it is today. And yeah, it really sparked up seriously there.
And a shout out to the Indian pilot who was shot down. There was a fascinating story in the New York Times today saying that when he was shot down, when he landed, he asked, when his parachute landed, he asked what country he was in. The villagers said Pakistan. He started running back toward India.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Yeah. When he realized he wasn't going to make it and the villagers were chasing him, he jumped into a pond. And while he was in the pond, he ate the maps and classified documents that he had on
wow.
his person.
Wow.
So that they couldn't be confiscated. The villagers finally pulled him out of the pond, but there was nothing to confiscate. He had eaten it all, and they beat him. Well, a Pakistani soldier got the villagers to stop beating him, and then once he was in custody, he wouldn't say a word besides name, rank, and serial number.
Yeah, that's what they trained to do.
Respect.
out of a spy novel.
Big respect for that guy.
Hey, John, you would have done the same thing.
I would have done the same thing. I've never told this story before. I was actually arrested in Yemen one time in 1991, and I was put into a holding cell carrying a diplomatic pouch. And they kept insisting that they wanted to break the seal. I knew what was in that pouch.
Right.
And I was going to lay down my life before they broke that seal.
No, that's right.
And as it turned out, and I was in that jail for 8 hours, but they never touched the diplomatic pouch.
But you didn't eat it.
I didn't eat it. But the fists were going to fly, I'll tell you that.
That's right.
Wow. Okay. Well, there's a lot more here. I mean, it seems like this guy is going to get released now.
Yeah, probably
today. They only released him, I heard.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And Pakistan made some interesting decisions, right? Because they did retaliate militarily, but I think, I mean, at least some reports are saying they just kind of bombed like an open field and then it's just like, hey, we can bomb you if we want to. And I don't know, but again, right, there's always the possibility of a miscalculation.
I think one of the reasons that decision was made on the part of Pakistan is because the Indian military is a lot more powerful. Pakistan is not in the position right now economically or militarily to engage India in an all-right conflict, and they know that. So, I mean, beside the nukes, and the nukes also aren't as maintained as the Indian nukes. You know, so we have to look at it that way. Who is actually at the helm in Pakistan? I mean, do we really know? You know, so.
Well, that's a good question. If I could interrupt you for a second, because the reality is that there are two parallel Pakistani governments.
Right.
There's Imran Khan and the civilian leadership, and then there's the military. And the military works more closely with the U.S. military than it does with its own government,
exactly.
With its own civilian leadership. Now, they've done that on purpose because they recognize that in the event of a fundamentalist or religious takeover of the government, the military does not want the nuclear weapons to fall into the hands of those radicals.
Right.
And so there's a plan in place that in the event that the Pakistani government is overthrown and a fundamentalist government takes its place, the nuclear weapons will be immediately transferred to the United States.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So there it is. And I think that that's one of the decisions why they rather bomb the open field, because I think the United States has given a lot of assistance to the Indian military over the last few years. So they've gotten a lot of their weaponry updated, and the United States has allied more with them in those terms because of trying, I think, to isolate Pakistan a little bit through, you know, this so-called war on terror and everything. But John is correct. It's like we don't know who's at the helm there.
No.
And so I think that I really believe that the Pakistani military made that decision not to fully engage. I don't think we're going to have an all out war because Pakistan knows that right now they're not in a position to do it.
Yeah, I agree with that. In India, there's going to be an election, I think, in May. And so, you know, Narendra Modi, he's the head of a party called the BJP, which is like a religious sort of like Hindu nationalist is kind of the common way to describe it. It's a right-wing party, a conservative party, and it's different than the traditional ruling party, the Indian National Congress, which is secular and generally speaking, you know, progressive. India's constitution actually technically defines it as a socialist country. There's a lot of history at play. So, you know, like, okay, India was aligned with the Soviet Union and they're enemies with Pakistan. And because the Soviet Union was enemies of China because of the Sino-Soviet split, then Pakistan became an ally of China. And then China and India fought a border war in the 1960s. So it's like this very like complicated web of different conflicts going on. But yeah, once you introduce like nuclear weapons to the situation, it gets really,
exactly.
Really scary.
It does. Yep.
Okay, let's move on. I think we only have a few minutes left, but there are some big developments. First of all, Benjamin Netanyahu was indicted. Jackie, we've got about 3 minutes left. What's the significance of this development?
Benjamin Netanyahu is basically the counterpart of Trump. And that's the way he's responding to this issue. He's using almost the exact same. Oh, it's a witch hunt. You know, this is unprecedented. You know, it's very much reminiscent of the kinds of issues that Trump is facing. Only I think in Israel, they actually have proof. They actually have evidence that Netanyahu has been involved in, that he's accepted bribes and that he's been involved in fraud. And this is coming right before the elections, I think in May, that they have set for Israel. Netanyahu may very well lose if he is not found guilty and sent to prison. And he was in trouble anyway because he had aligned himself with a far right, just openly racist.
They call it the KKK of Israel.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
A faction in Israel. So he was in trouble anyway. This almost guarantees that he will not win this, that he will no longer be the prime minister of Israel. But his potential replacement is not much better than he is. So it doesn't mean anything much different, I don't think, for the Palestinian people.
I'll take issue with that real quickly. Not on everything, but I would not throw dirt on Benjamin Netanyahu until you know that he is really buried.
I agree with you.
That's a good point. Yeah. That's a good point.
I wouldn't do that. But that was my only contention with that.
And even then, he has a history of coming back from
that's
the dead.
That's my point.
That's true. That's a good point. Point taken.
So the way he won the last election, he on election day, he tweeted, "The Arabs are voting in droves," right? That's the direct quote, right? And so it was sort of like a way to boost right-wing, you know, Jewish nationalists, like, turnout. Right. And so, you know, the question is, I think, can he pull the same maneuver this time around? Because, you know, there are a lot of, you know, Palestinians who have citizenship in Israel, that's second-class citizenship, but they still do have the right to vote. And so because of the way sort of coalition politics works in Israel, it seems likely if this... I mean, it's being presented as a centrist party. I don't think that's actually an accurate label for it. I mean, it's led by generals, right, who, you know, have carried out these horrible war crimes. But anyway, you know, for them to form a coalition that has a majority in the parliament, they might have to ally with, an Arab party, right, to make the to make the math work. But I think that's going to be Netanyahu's attack line. I think that might be how he survives, because it's just like, hey, you guys really want an Arab party being part of the governing coalition. I think that might be effective considering the direction that Israeli politics is going. We're going to have to leave it right there, though. You've been listening to our weekly segment, The Week in Review, where we go over the biggest stories in politics, policy, and international affairs with Jacqueline Lukman and Abdus Lukman. They're the co-editors-in-chief of Lukman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.